Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. So, do you use the phrases stressed out and burned out interchangeably? If you do, turns out you are wrong. New research finds that stress is to burnout, as feeling blue is to clinical depression. So, what drives us to burnout? Can we save ourselves from being fried? Joining us, as she does every Tuesday, to discuss this is Nancy Kane. Nancy's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, I hope you know, is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey, Nancy.
Hey, great to be here.
It's great, by the way, as soon as the guy starts talking about, what is it, disease-proof, she walks in with a bag of cookies she baked.
Sort of but they're great cookies. Segue. They're worth every single calorie. So what is the difference between being burned out and being stressed out, Nancy?
So, you know, I did some research on this because it's something I actually deal with indirectly all the time, coaching executives. But interestingly enough, burnout is not in the dictionary of mental stress disorders, interestingly enough. However, it is on lots of websites, like the Mayo Clinic website. And so I hesitate to offer anything like a medical definition. But burnout is characterized by longer standing or longer term symptoms that are deeper than what most of us would call everyday stress and anxiety, right? Low-level fear, to be technical about it, including, you know, great disillusionment, a sense of powerlessness, a sense often of cynicism and disengagement. And then it follows, interestingly enough, because of our, you know, increasing awareness as a society of the mind-body connection, it follows into a series of physical symptoms, from insomnia to different kinds of issues with food, from not eating to eating too much to drinking too much to ultimately some kind of, you know, significantly reduced levels of daily functioning.
How big
really?
A thing?
So
how
it's,
big
it's
is
a
this?
Spectrum.
Is it, not only how big is this, but is it also primarily a modern phenomenon? I would guess the level is. Is that true?
So again, the amount of research on this compared to, say, things like clinical depression is much lower. So we have a much smaller library, if you will, of data. But there are a number of people in the New York Times article
let me
that
tell
referring
you,
to.
My parents had big dreams for their kids, but I'm not sure it was this
about
big.
Different researchers around the world who studied this. It is definitely, Jim, a symptom. Do we want to call it a disease, a disorder, a manifestation that is increasing and that seems to be positively correlated, no big surprise here, with industrialization?
You work more, you're less appreciated, and you make less. I mean, is that not the summation for what the problem
exactly.
is?
Exactly. And then you carry it inward and you feel less good about yourself, less good about your coworkers, less good about your village and your tribe, less good about your family, less good about just taking the next step every day. And again, I've worked with very high-powered business people that deal with you know, the stress that all of us deal with in their worlds. And I have watched, you know, stress slip over into burnout with people. And it is noticeably different. It is noticeably different, right, to see someone engaged and anxious, engaged and tapping, engaged and checking their cell phone and, you know, tuned out or tuned down or much, much less capable and positive about what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
And it's, again, like all kinds of depression. Remember the spate of articles over the last 3 weeks about the relationship between insomnia and depression treatments?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
P.S. If you get more sleep, depression treatments and depression treatments work better, whether they're therapy or medicine or both. And P.S., depression lifts. Same kind of thing here. Right, this is a cycle, just like depression, that gets tighter and tighter and worse and worse.
Well, there's a line in this piece from the New York Times that says that researchers say stress is to burnout as feeling blue is to clinical depression.
Right.
So it is a wholly different thing, and it's not uniquely American either. I felt good about that at least. I was like, you know, misery loves company. That we're, if we're stressed out and burned out, that much of the industrialized world is also stressed out and burned out, and even Europe, where you think of them being more relaxed.
The Dutch, right? Tall, healthy, long-lived, and multilingual, and seemingly, somewhat, at least in my own experience, extraordinarily well-balanced, you know, group of people are suffering from higher levels of burnout than they did 20 years ago. And they actually have interesting solutions that would involve, say, taking 6 weeks off from work. Well, that may not fly here in this country.
Talk to you about that in a minute, because I think that is the solution. The fact that we have an average of 2 weeks vacation in this country and the rest of the world has 4, 6, 8, I think is part of the problem. But, you know, as we're talking, you're talking about the industrialized world and that sort of thing. You deal with business executives a lot. And I'm saying to myself, is this a function of people in the middle in the bottom, or is it suffer as much at the top? And as I'm thinking it, you from Harvard Business School, the highest profile example of burnout I can think of in my lifetime is Neil Rudenstein, former president of Harvard, on the cover of Newsweek. Do you remember what the one word on the cover was?
Exhausted.
It was a picture of the then president of Harvard with a banner headline across saying exhausted. I mean, that was, even though he never really got into it much, that's what that was about. It was about burnout in this high-pressure, high-stakes environment, right?
And to his credit and the people around him, right, he took a time out, right, and came back. He did. Came back and was an extraordinarily effective president, right, and guide and map maker for Harvard. So it's not, but it's not just confined to, I think, the C-suite, as we say. You know, if you think about where it was first diagnosed, it was actually first diagnosed among service workers, particularly among docs, nurses, police officers, EMTs, firefighters.
Why? Because the stakes were so high, or why?
I don't know if that's why it was picked up. I don't know if that's why we caught it there first, or if it actually occurred there first and was diagnosed there first, because these are people dealing in, as you said, very, very high stakes situations, often, right, on rhythms and hours that aren't necessarily natural. Think of the graveyard shift, 11 to 7, if you're an EMT worker. And I think that there, right, being disengaged or losing a sense of competence and empowerment, right, is particularly noticeable. And incidentally, right, you know, it's like don't get sick in July, right? has important, again, big heavy consequences. So that's where it was first isolated or identified, and it's there that most of the research has been done, but by no means all.
You know, we were talking earlier about this survey that was done that showed only one third of Americans, down from 50% in the 70s, trust their fellow Americans, and a decent number of the callers who said that they were actually trusting people said that they thought the problem was the lack of human connection. Obviously, I mean, it seems to me that also is an element here with the burn is when you don't have human connections and your relationship is to a machine or through a machine to other people. It would seem to me that would exacerbate this situation. No,
I think it does, Jim, very much so. And you know, there was a spate of research about 7 years ago. The New York Times published it in a series of front page articles about the relationship between the incidence of depression and the time people spent positive correlation and the time people spent on their smartphones and on their computers. So I think there's an element of
and there's an inverse proportion. Obviously, the more time on your smartphone and computer, the less
engaged.
Right. Okay,
and the less supported you feel.
I think
a lot of it's about support and our tribal village, right? There's a wonderful set of German terms in social history called the movement from Gemeinschaft to Gesellschaft. It's used among a lot of European historians.
I say that all the time. I want you to know.
But let me explain what it means. It's really interesting. It's the idea that once long ago, in a state of Gemeinschaft, meaning a kind of comfortable set of communal relationships, little towns and little villages looked after each other. Think of it as the extended family that we all romanticize today. And that over time, the market economy and the coming of industrialization brought us to a state that was much more transactional, much more Gesellschaft, much more about buying and selling. What did Wordsworth say? Buying and selling, but getting and spending. We lay waste our powers.
Yeah.
And I think that we are living in a world that is increasingly transactional, and our phones and our computers and our tablets are making it even more so. At the same time, so they were less supported. Right. So we're less appreciated. We have less human connection on a day to day basis that seems intimate and real. But there's something else that's going on. And we've talked about this in different ways on this show. You folks talk about it a lot. I think, you know, even is it Dr. Katz?
Dr. Katz. Yeah.
Dr. Katz was talking about indirectly yesterday, and he was talking about, you know, how families can nurture and lead people toward health as opposed to, you know, doing something that's hard and martyred about preventing disease. You know, we are living in an age in which there is less and less social lubrication. And I mean by that just please and thank you. I appreciate that. Have a nice day, ma'am. Think of all the small little acts of kindness and civility that are no longer so much a part of all of our days. Those things indirectly give us connection. They're skeins and glue that bind us together in ways that can't be measured by, you know, an Amazon drone delivery time, right? Or how much we get off on our next holiday purchase by shopping smart with our iPad. We are missing that, and I think that's contributing to a sense of being disconnected, disengaged, and less supported. And all of that are runway conditions, you know, given certain circumstances for burnout.
Well, yeah, I want to make underline what you just said, Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School, and then say the opposite, even though it is not a disagreement. And this is something Marjorie says all the time. You say we feel disengaged, we don't feel connected to people. Part of the problem that it seems to me leads to burnout is we're never unconnected. I mean, one of the things Marjorie says is that someone can get you 24/7. It used to be you go home, you go home. It used to be you go on vacation, you go on vacation. We are accessible anywhere, anytime, anywhere in the world, which it seems to me creates a certain level of tension that's a breeding ground for this kind of burnout that they're talking about in this piece, right?
Absolutely. 24/7, right? And so, you know, I work with executives that can't unplug from their phone, even on vacation.
What do you say to them? What do you say in it?
I say, how's your family feel about this? And they tell you stories like, literally, this happened last summer at an executive coaching institute where one very high-powered advertising agency executive said, I was on my phone so much and so busy with work at home that my wife grabbed the phone and threw it out the front door in front of the kids. And so we all waited with bated breath in front of a group. And I said, and then what did you do? And he said, well, I ran out the door and got it.
What else would he do?
So that was like the Crackberries. Remember the story a few years ago when everyone was still into Blackberries? It was in the Wall Street Journal, I think, about the kids throwing their parents Crackberries, as they called them, because they were just like crack down the toilet.
Absolutely.
And stuff like that out the car window because they were so sick of it. And you see this all the time.
All the time.
With mothers walking their kids in the stroller or at the park with their kids playing, and the kid is falling off the monkey bars and mom doesn't notice because she's buried in the phone. I mean, you see that all the time.
So I think that, Jim, I think you're absolutely right. There are no more borders. There are no more boundaries, right? So there is no more chance to regroup, gather your wind behind your wings, feel like a hawk again, empowered, you know, soaring the currents. And instead, we end up, you know, at the end of the day, often very, very depleted, right? All outbox, no inbox in terms of our sense of connection and support. And I think that is what burnout is about, all those days added together.
Yeah.
And just like depression, the sense, and at least in my own experience working with people, that individuals don't see anything they can do about it. Right?
Well, that's where I want to go. And by the way, in a minute, after a couple of minutes after Nancy leaves, we're going to take your calls on whether you think you have experienced burnout and whether you have or not, what you think the cure is. Have you? I mean, you are really all over the place. Last night, Marty, you were on Emily Rooney's show last night. You're running out of here to do another radio show. You're teaching. You have this endless litany of responsibilities.
That's right.
You ever suffer from burnout or anything close to it?
I do. I've learned over the years. The last 10 years of my life have been like just one calamity after another: death, destruction, cancer one, cancer two, accident one, accident two, physical accidents, breaking things. And so I've just, you know, it's really very Jobian, right, the last decade. And so I've learned that in order to keep – this was the school of hard knocks. I knew none of this. I learned it all by pushback learning, like a child, you know, bumping into a hot stove or touching a hot pot. I've learned that it's very, very important that I have a couple of parts of my life where – I can do something very, very different that makes me sing, so to speak.
Is that your horse deal?
That's my horse. My horses were all about healing, right? Mm-hmm. I'd never ridden a horse. My husband had left me. I'd lost all my money. I was in shock. I'd lost 20 pounds in 10 days. I was falling apart, and I decided, I'd always been an athlete. My sister dragged me out with my niece to go take a horseback riding consultation lesson, and there I was on the five-year-olds, with the five-year-olds on the ponies, on the lead line, and that was the beginning. Right. So it was a comedy of errors, but it was also a way of being in a completely different place, right? A very different rhythm. No iPads at the stable, right?
No.
It was absolutely healing and absolutely rejuvenating. And it still is for me every day that I ride. So, you know, finding something like that, whether it's dancing or singing or knitting or reading Shakespeare, whatever it is, right? You know, my manicurist is just taken up tanga. She's about 60 and gorgeous, and it's like discovered tanga. And she's a her whole
what's tanga?
Tango lessons.
Oh,
they call tango it tanga.
Lessons.
The tanga.
Okay, okay.
Right? And she, you know, sashays into the nail salon in her 4-inch heels.
Oh, God.
Looking like a movie star, and it is just that kind of tonic. So everyone needs a tonic.
Okay, but
that's one thing that's
where
useful.
The individual takes control. Yeah. Let's go back to one of these executive coaching sessions you have, and one of the executives raises his or her hand and says, okay, Nancy Kane, tell me three things I should do at my workplace to make it less likely that the people I care about, the people who work with me and for me, are going to experience the kind of burnout you're talking about. And you're the czar of this. What do I do?
Okay. First thing is you need to create some place where a communal meeting, something where the phones get stacked up. We've talked about this before, the phone stack, right? So that people actually can listen and look at each other and engage in a very important reason they came to work here in the first place, which is to deal with the other people. Most people get a lot out of the people around them when they're not tuned out and burned out, right? So that's the first thing. The second thing is small acts of gratitude and appreciation. It's like Dr. Katz talking about moving. We all know this, and yet it gets so easily airbagged out with all the other stuff taking up the oxygen, right? Thank you. I appreciate that. One of the things I do, and I've had lots of executives do this too, and it's very simple, and it's very, very easy for a senior executive or a manager to do this, is at a time when you're feeling particularly unempowered, right, powerless, whatever, disengaged, you make up a little balance sheet. I'm doing it here in the studio, and you say, what were the three positive things that happened this morning? And you just stop there. Right. Three positive things. You know, oh, my dog jumped up and didn't knock me over and kissed me. Right. Oh, the woman at Starbucks smiled so nicely and gave me a second shot for free. Right. My car started on this cold winter morning. So the ability of the chief executive or a manager to do that kind of accounting and then bring it in just the tiniest way to someone in the office has especially if other people know about it, right? Thank you, Marjorie, for that fantastic comment on the show. We all learn so much. Boy, does that spread like contagion.
That is
right?
Very true.
Because here's the real secret sauce. The secret sauce is that it's all about moving the energy among a group or with yourself.
What does that mean?
Like, think about Shackleton, your hero. I'm just writing the introduction to that chapter this morning, right? What I really try and do, Jim, mostly is write the really important tough stuff. So what did Shackleton do so well? He kept shifting the energy, not letting the men's energy go onto the burnout, hopeless side of the spectrum, right? Always trying to manage their energy. And when he felt that it was flagging, he'd give them a hot drink or he'd say something funny. Or guess what? He would dance in a waltz across the ice with Frank Wilde, his second in command. He really did that. So the secret is how do we move the energy in the group? The manager has huge amounts of agency over that, so that it's about, again, personal connection and positive upward flowing rather than, oh, my God, it's Monday morning and I'm here at my smartphone getting ready for this meeting to begin. So this aspect of moving the negative or stagnant or, hopeless energy away and moving in is really the key. And that's the key to a lot of what David Katz is talking about, right? Around how we eat and how we move or what we do in terms of like the things that give us passion. It's about moving energy into positive pockets and then letting our wings lift on that.
But see, every one of those makes total sense to me. And I hate to move from the spiritual to the mundane.
Yeah.
But you were operating in spiritual territory. All those things, by the way, are free. They're things you can just do on the snap of a finger. But let's for a minute, before you go, talk about the things that do cost money. It seems to me that in an era when everybody feels they have to work 24/7
and
can't leave
the
workplace, right, because they're worried the guy or woman next to them, one, employers should require, Marjorie and I fight about this all the time, should require their employees to take every single vacation day they have. If you have 2 weeks of vacation, you should take 2 weeks of vacation. Two, I said at the beginning of this discussion, and this is one of the things we're going to talk about after you leave, the average American has 2 weeks of vacation.
Yeah.
The rest of the world has 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks. How can you be healthy mentally and physically and work? How can an employer feel you can be healthy when he or she says you only need 10 days off out of 52 weeks a year to recharge, to relax, to read a book, whatever? It just can't happen. That's got to change in this country.
That's got to change. I don't know that we'll get to Europe's system with 6 weeks of vacation, but we could get to, and there are lots of progressive offices where, for example, managers very pointedly leave at 6 o'clock. Right. Or they take a 2-hour lunch break because they go to the gym or they go to their tanga class or they go to their piano lesson. I'm not kidding. I've worked with people who did all these things. Yeah. And by the way, once a manager does it, suddenly, guess what happens to the energy in the office? And guess what? Now their coworkers or their employees feel like they have leave to do. So I think we need, here's what I think, we need more attention. Financial, this is a financial issue too. People are much more productive when they're engaged, when they're restored, when they've recovered, when they're not on the line between stress and burnout. So that means we need much more conscious attention at the institutional level to how are we managing the energy and engagement of our people. And that means that starts with the manager doing it for himself. We're back to cats again, right? And if we started quantifying this, and there are studies that have done this, there's a really interesting guy in Florida named Jim Lehrer, not Jim Lehrer of the NewsHour, L-O-E-H-R, who wrote an incredible book called The Power of Full Engagement, which quantifies what happens when people stop feeling like they have to work 12-hour days and start working really effectively for 7 and then recovering for 5. Huh. So we need a paradigm shift here on some of this.
Well, you know what I wonder too, though, if people also need something almost every day, you know,
absolutely.
A little, I mean, that's why people meditate, so they can get their little half hour of vacation mm-hmm. in every day and look forward to it and have that time to block everything out, because that kind of fortifies you to put up with a lot of...
I think we need our little vacations. I think, honestly, I don't think any meeting should ever last more than an hour. I think we, or it certainly shouldn't last more than an hour without plenty of food and victuals, yeah. as Shackleton would say, and a stretch break, right? Because we have to be able to nurture, right, all kinds of the mortal coil, which is our mind and our bodies and our emotions, as we live in this make, you know, less, do more, harsh, you know, increasingly fast spinning flywheel of capitalism. So, yes, vacations every day and little recovery breaks every hour.
Yeah, little recovery breaks every
hour. And don't forget to dance.
You know, she's in a room with a guy, me, who works 2.5 hours a day, and I'm complaining. 2 hours here, a half hour in Newton, and then I'm home.
Well, it's a lot of preparation.
Whatever.
Jim. A lot of preparation.
Hey, Nancy, it's great to see you as always.
Always a pleasure.
You're not burnt out.
I'm not burnt out.
Good.
Look at her. Are you kidding me? No.
Neither am I. Are you?
Are you kidding me?
Okay. Nancy Cannon is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. And her latest book, which she just talked about, is Ernest Shackleton Exploring Leadership. When we come back, we're going to ask you guys, are you burned out? And when you have been burned out, what do you do? And how do you get out of it? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.